On this episode of Doula to Doula, we are talking about induction methods. Welcome, and thanks for joining us on another episode of Doula to Doula, where we talk about pregnancy, birth, motherhood, and the doula life. I'm Exie Bueller, a certified labor and birth doula and childbirth educator. I'm also a licensed and board certified massage therapist and owner of Tranquil Touch Therapeutic Massage for Women. My co-host is Chana Vaughn.
I'm a doula in training, just beginning my journey as a birth professional. Together, we're going to help each other grow, give each other support, and see how we apply our doula skills to everyday life. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, Chana. How you doing?
Hi, Exie. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. So it is Sunday and that we're recording this, and you have some time off coming up, right?
I do. I'm so excited. I've been waiting for some time off, and yeah, I'm trying not to have in my mind like things that I'm going to get accomplished because I just want to chill.
Yeah, have some time with those littles and enjoy the nicer weather and not living on a schedule for a few days.
Yes, that would be so nice. Yep.
Yeah. So talking about schedules, inductions. Inductions are oftentimes because we are such schedule-oriented people, aren't we?
We are. Yeah, our lives, most of our lives are run off of schedules. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you and I, we've both had experiences with induction. And when we were going over this, discussing the different methods of induction and things and the different reasons for induction, you had kind of an awareness, an epiphany. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I think everyone, especially if you're doing like a non-medical or sort of induction, you may want to do things for different reasons. And I was trying to figure out like, why did I want to? And it's so easy when you have a due date and a date for anything, you know, to want to have a project or something done by that date. So I actually, I had a failed induction. Do you remember that with Harper? I was induced in the hospital, but I went home. I didn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. I do remember that. And we were going to go into depth about that whole thing, right? In our next episode about the medical inductions, but I had actually forgotten that it was classified as a failed induction. Yeah. And it actually, when we really started looking at things though, Harper wasn't your first induction, right?
It wasn't. I kind of like self-induced. I didn't even realize that I was trying to like quote unquote induce my labor. I just knew that one of my girlfriends whose due date was close to mine, she had her baby, and I was like, oh no, I'm having this baby. So I did kind of a Google search, which I don't recommend, and found natural induction methods, and I went about in a roundabout way inducing my labor or trying to at least.
So, and you were not yet at your due date with your Lee when you did the castor oil, right?
Right. So, well, I did a lot of things leading up to that. I tried everything that, quote unquote, Dr. Google told me to try. So I had eggplant parmesan and spicy foods, and, I kind of did everything that I could think of, but my due date, I did it about a day or two before my due date with Yorley. I took the castor oil, and actually the day before my due date, I took castor oil. I also had my membrane stripped at my doctor's appointment prior to that, and I just knew that that was going to be it because my girlfriend had that. She had her membrane stripped, and then off into labor she went a couple hours later. So I believe that after I left that doctor's appointment, my midwife appointment, having been stripped, that I just knew like we were going to be heading to the hospital in a matter of hours. And when that didn't happen, I was like, oh no, I'm going to do something. So I sent my husband to a 24-hour CVS to get a bottle of castor oil in the middle of the night.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so that was in our last episode when you went into detail about the lovely effects that you experienced from the castor oil.
I do not recommend without communicating with your medical provider or your midwife or because, yeah, if you check out our previous episode, you'll see that I had lots of unusual, unwelcome side effects to the castor oil. It's used for more things than just labor. I'll tell you that.
Right. Yeah. So now when we talk about induction, you mentioned that there's the non-medical or more social reasons for induction. And so that's more like convenience. Did you have, because you were a working mom at the time, did you have a maternity leave date that you were trying to work around?
Well, I knew that I wanted to have as much of my maternity leave available to me as possible. And my midwife had actually taken me off of work several days before, before I ended up having Yorley, my daughter. So I knew like that clock was ticking. My husband had actually started kind of his paternal leave from work because it seemed like labor was progressing. So he started his leave. So I wanted him to be at home with me and our new baby. And I think, for some women, their partner may be off early or they may have a certain date that they have to give their employer for a leave. So that could definitely be one of the reasons that, a birth mother may be compelled to start that labor.
So what are some other, so you did the research for today's episode on these natural, non-pharmaceutical, doctor, midwife, nurse does not have to be present types of induction. So we just kind of hit on your personal experience with castor oil, but why don't you take over here and share with everybody what you found?
So there's lots of different ways, natural induction methods per se, and some of them are things that you consume. And then there's also different techniques that you can do regarding different parts of your body, different stimulation. But a lot of the more common ones are the castor oil. There's another one, the red raspberry leaf tea. Very different from raspberry tea. Regular raspberry tea is not going to do the trick. It may taste a little bit better. But red raspberry leaf tea. Also, one that I had not heard of before was date fruit. I didn't know that dates could be linked in some cases to helping induce labor. There's some correlation that I was reading about that to oxytocin receptors in different studies. Red raspberry leaf tea, while it tends to be the least invasive as far as what you're consuming, and there weren't any adverse outcomes, it also didn't really show that it really impacted labor that much. But I was able to get a lot of information from another podcast that both you and I really appreciate, and that's Evidence-Based Births. She has several podcasts that are about inducing labor with natural methods. And another method that a lot of people tend to try to do is nipple stimulation. All these things to try to reduce that oxytocin and get the body ready to prepare for labor. So those are very, and another one that I also ran across was consuming pineapple core. That just does not sound like fun for me. I love pineapple, the core, not so much. I couldn't imagine. I really have to be desperate and at the end of my rope to do that one. So there's lots of different ways that women may, or birth moms may try to induce their labor, lots of different methods. Like I said, I have experience. I kind of just found a document on Google in 2010 that had a lot of different ways when I was trying to, unbeknownst to me, really kind of induce my labor. But in some of them, especially in the castor oil, that one really shocked me to see that not my body's reaction to that was not quote unquote typical, because there was a study.
Really?
Yeah, there was a study done by Rebecca Decker with Evidence-Based Birth. Well, not done by her, but she had a lot of the information about it. And it was showing that out of the 323 women that were a part of a certain study that only 7 experienced nausea, 3 experienced vomiting, and 1 experienced severe diarrhea. And I would have checked all 3 of those boxes just by myself. So it could have been a dosing thing, because you get so many different, there's so many different ways that you can consume these things. And the internet is not a you know, one size fits all. So it could have been that I overdosed, or that I took 2 doses. It could have been that I took them too close together. So as always, I highly recommend that people speak with their medical practitioner or their midwife or OBGYN. And also for the date fruit, that one seems to have the least amount of side effects. So like I was saying, there's lots of different methods that can be used. And thankfully, a lot of them didn't seem to affect the Apgar scores or the scores taken after delivery for any of the babies. So that's, I'm sure for a lot of moms, a huge sigh of relief. But you really want to make sure that you, if you're considering one of these options, that you check out the dosage, talk to your healthcare provider about it. Because we have different genetic makeup, so we may respond differently to different sorts of treatments.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, so you listed the 3, castor oil, red raspberry leaf tea, and dates. The castor oil goes back a lot, like our mothers and aunts and, you know, grandmothers maybe even might have recommended castor oil. It's been around for a long time. Red raspberry leaf tea is one that is more modern, right?
I'd say it's more modern for sure. Castor oil is definitely part of the old wives' tale. Oh, you want to have that baby? You just take a cap full of castor oil. And dates, I feel like that has to be fairly new, because I Googled everything under the sun and I don't recall ever seeing that. So I feel like those would definitely have to be newer ones.
Yeah. So as a doula, you know, red raspberry leaf tea is one that we've talked about, you know, those of us in the doula world in the last 10 years or so. I've been doing this for 15. So it's one that we've talked about. It's one that gets kicked around a lot of forums. You see a lot of women asking about the use of red raspberry leaf tea. And of course, as doulas or childbirth educators, and even as a massage therapist, it's out of the scope of practice for us to prescribe anything. But I do know, as far as the red raspberry leaf tea, not necessarily in terms of induction so much as it does help to tone the uterus and may make the eventual contractions more effective, right? Is that in line with the information that you found?
Absolutely, absolutely. Red raspberry leaf tea is actually highly correlated to the toning of the uterus. And I guess I'm a little bit more health conscious than I was aware of, because I had actually started drinking red raspberry leaf tea even prior to trying to conceive to help with menstrual cycles. So I had read that it really, really helps the uterus, and it helps improve blood flow and all sorts of different things. And I personally did experience a difference with that, which is a positive. So yeah, there's not a lot necessarily if you're looking to kind of help you become with your, let's say you're worried about effacement or dilation, these things may not necessarily help in that regard. If they do, there's very little scientific evidence that may show. There was some studies done where they were looking at tissue samples of the cervix and of the uterus after a woman's body had these sort of things ingested and processed by the body. But unfortunately, it's not necessarily a science-backed, hard stamp yes.
Yeah. And it's very difficult, really, to study labor and birth, because very few women will sign up and say, sure, I'll be the guinea pig for this.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, my baby and I, because you don't know. And there are so many variabilities that go into how a labor and birth unfold that it's very difficult to have a control group where, you know, whatever it is that you're studying is not part of the equation or purposely withheld.
Mm-hmm.
in order to keep that control group the way that it is. I'm no research expert, but that's the feeling that I've gotten, is that just over the years, is just that it's a difficult thing, and many things in labor and birth are looked at retrospectively.
Right.
So you mentioned a couple studies where they were studying it as it happened, but it was not so much within a controlled environment.
Correct. And I do have to say, especially in regards to the dates, I did not see any studies that were done with women that had like diabetes or hypertension. So I really would recommend that if, you know, you're on that spectrum, you're diabetic, or your doctor has any indication that you may be developing gestational diabetes, I would recommend against trying the date fruits. They do have a large amount of sugar. There's syrup that's made from the dates. And so I just want to throw that out there. I would not recommend that as a method.
Yeah, good point. Very good point. Okay. So those are kind of the natural over-the-counter methods. You did mention the stripping of the membranes, and that is something that is done at an office appointment with either a midwife or a doctor. And I know that that is technically considered a potential induction method, but really it happens so routinely, I find, that what I tell my clients either in birth class or as their doula is, if you really want labor to get started completely on its own and be spontaneous with no intervention at all, then at that 38, 39, 40 week, 41 week visit, keep your underpants on.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes it has been known that a provider will do a membrane strip without the birthing person aware, because they're thinking they're just getting a normal vaginal exam that is routine at the end of pregnancy to be put in the chart. And what the doctor or midwife might actually be doing is more invasively getting down in there a little bit deeper to strip those membranes. So it is something that I just tell everybody, if you don't want it, just keep your underpants on.
Exactly.
Because the vaginal exam really just gives you a portrait of a moment in time. It's not what we say, cervixes aren't crystal balls. They're not going to tell you you're going to go into labor in this many hours or in this many days, and this is how long your labor is going to be. So all it does is gives them an idea of where you might be at that moment in time.
And another thing that I noticed, just me personally, is it kind of gave me a little bit of false hope, because after you have that invasive, you know, where your membranes are stripped, there's going to be some discomfort. There's going to be some cramping for most women. I experienced it. I had some spotting. So those are also all early labor signs. So I left the appointment. You know, I felt like, oh, these don't feel like Braxton Hicks contractions. Maybe, you know, something got jump started. And as they started to subside later on that evening, I was like heartbroken. You know?
Yeah, discouragement starts to set in.
Exactly. And I think that also, in my mind, made me really want to jumpstart that labor, because I had what felt like all the symptoms of early labor, and then for them to just diminish, it was very discouraging. So I agree with your recommendation, you know, keep your pants on if you can, unless there's a medical reason for you to be checked. Of course, we won't go against that advice, but if you're, it can take you down a path that you don't necessarily have to be, as we know that labor can be looked different for a lot of different women, so.
Right, right. Yeah. And so let's talk, you know, we mentioned the, you know, just the social convenience, whatever the case might be. But let's talk a little bit about the medical reasons. Now, before I begin on that, I just want to reference the Listening to Mother survey. So this came out in, I want to say, this one was 2013, I think. And they happen every few years, and they survey women, birth givers who have had babies within a certain amount of time. This particular one was the third survey, and it surveyed 2,400 women, I believe. And one of the reasons that you and I wanted to talk about induction is because it is so prevalent, right? So in this report, it was found that some 41% of women, I want to say, were induced.
Wow.
So that's a, so more than 4 out of 10 indicated that their care provider tried to induce their labor. And 3 out of 4 women were the ones experiencing a medical induction. So when we're talking about reasons why a doctor or a midwife might want to induce, maybe there's some high blood pressure like you were talking about. Maybe there's intrauterine growth restriction of the baby. But the number one reason that women in the survey stated that they were induced was because they were near or past their due date. So we talked a little bit at the beginning about living on a schedule. So many of us live on a schedule. And what many people don't realize is that in 2013, there was a committee opinion released by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which kind of returned the definition of pregnancy. So back when I had my kids, 37 weeks was considered full term. You can have your baby anytime after 37 weeks because you're full term, the baby's quote unquote fully cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for me, what I did not realize is that most of the finer things, so the final maturation of the lungs, the synapses of the brain, so the nervous system, those things happen in those last couple of weeks. So allowing baby to have those real fine details happen is really important. And so the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology released this committee opinion in November of 2013. So if you have your baby between 37 weeks and 0 days to 38 weeks and 6 days, a baby born during that time period is now considered early term.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, not full term, but early term. So full term are babies who are born between 39 weeks and 0 days to 40 weeks and 6 days. So that includes those babies who go past, quote unquote, past their due date. Late term babies are any babies that are born from 41 weeks and 0 days to 41 weeks plus 6 days. So you can get right up to the edge of that 42-week mark, and your baby is still not clinically defined as being post-term. Post-term babies are now defined as any babies born from 42 weeks and 0 days and beyond.
Wow.
And the beyond is usually going to happen in like a home birth environment. You occasionally you'll read a story of a baby being born at 43 weeks. And there's always, to me, there's always, anytime I hear any birth story, I always want to know all the details. So, okay. So you say 43 weeks, tell me more. How do you know exactly when you conceived? I'd like to hear that, you know, all of that stuff. But this is now the ACOG accepted definition of pregnancy. And we talked in the past about how it takes a good 17 years for a medical specialty to across the board be evened up on a decision or a guideline or a change in practice. So women and birth givers who are listening to this now, they might be seeing a provider who still says 37 weeks, your baby's full term, your baby's fine to be born. But according to this definition that was adopted by ACOG, there's no real reason to rush outside of a clear medical indication where the health of mom, the birth giver, or the health of baby needs to have the birth happen in order for the health to be maintained. So there's something going on there where mom's health is compromised or baby's health is compromised should the pregnancy be continued. But barring anything specifically like that, then the recommendation is to let it happen on its own.
I have to say, I'm so happy about this recommendation for multiple reasons. And I think the main one is when I was going through my journey with, you know, trying to expand our family, the first thing that I found, they were blog posts. You know, the blogs were really, really popular then. And so I subscribed to all these blogs, and there were so many women who, once they hit 37 weeks, they started doing all these natural induction methods. And I just thought, like, oh, that's so, you know, at that point, you still typically would have at least 6 more prenatal appointments if you're going every 2 weeks. So yeah. You're missing out on a lot of FaceTime with your medical provider, and you know they're doing checks to check on you and check on baby, but there were so many that started to pull out their, you know, Dr. Google lists, and they were doing the castor oils and the, you know, nipple stimulation and different things to try to promote labor without specifying a cause to do so. I just want to make that clear. It's not, they weren't mentioning any medical reason. They weren't mentioning that their doctor had even, you know, encouraged them to do so. It was like they hit 37 weeks and like, you know, a flip was switched and they just thought, okay, baby needs to come out now. And I think having this extra amount of information is really helpful because it can help, you know, due dates, as you get closer, it's looming over your head. And if people that may have seemed like they're on the same timeline as you have given birth, you know, emotionally you may be feeling some type of way, but to know that, you know, baby still needs to cook, there's a benefit to doing so. I think that's really powerful, and that can empower women to kind of just stay the course. And as hard as it can be, as difficult as it may seem, and as cliche as it sounds, to enjoy those last few weeks of pregnancy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's the societal pressure to have your baby by a certain date. You know, as soon as you find out you're pregnant, people start asking, when is your baby due? And they don't expect to hear the month of May. They expect to hear May 17th. Mm-hmm. And if they could get a time that it would actually be born ahead of time, then they would be happy with that too. And in reality, it is a birth month. Mm-hmm. And in very few cases, you know, do we know absolutely when we conceive.
Right.
So most women who are active in having intercourse, they don't really know exactly that ovulation time. Yeah, you might have one date or 24 hours where it's especially potent, mm-hmm. but it could happen over a length of several days.
Right.
And outside of artificial reproduction therapy, you don't really know specifically the date.
Right.
So it is good for, and the human body is very different. And I have had clients who generationally, we've looked at grandmother and great grandmother and then the expectant mother, and we've seen all the women in their family fall into 42 week time period, or vice versa. All the women in their family tend to lean towards 39 weeks.
Right.
Going spontaneously. So genetics has a lot to do with it. And one thing that I remind my birth class participants is not only are you dealing with the birth giver, the pregnant person's genetic makeup, but you're also dealing with the other person, the donator, the fertilizer. That person's genetic makeup also is going to have an influence on the amount of time that a gestation takes place.
Absolutely.
So there's just a lot of variability to go to it. And like you said, we're not a library book that has, you know, our babies are not library books.
Or bills that have a certain date that has to be paid.
Now, we talked about some medical reasons. So pregnancy-induced hypertension, potential for preeclampsia, IUGR, the intrauterine growth restriction. Those are just a few of the real for sure medical reasons. And even with those, sometimes like pregnancy-induced hypertension, you may be able to manage that with the help of your doctor or your provider, getting NSTs, doing kit counts so that you can know and be marking or charting out that everything is okay with baby, and buying yourself another 24 hours, something like that. But that's going to be very individual, and they should discuss that with their provider. If you were to decide to, if a birth giver were to decide to go ahead and get a medical induction, a pharmaceutically managed induction, we are talking about the quote unquote least invasive would be that stripping of the membranes. But that is more, it's done in the office and you go and leave and go about your day. The following methods that I'm going to discuss happen in hospital. You are admitted, and in many cases, in most cases, you're going to be monitored in different ways. So the Foley or the Cook catheter, those are probably because they don't really mess with the hormones. They don't change the hormonal balance. You're not introducing chemicals into the body. What they're doing is they're placing a catheter, a rubber catheter, inside of the cervix, just inside. Your cervix does have to be open slightly in order for this to happen. And your waters do need to be intact. And then they will apply or insert saline solution to expand the end of the catheter to make it like a little balloon. And it rests against the edge of the cervix, because really what helps labor progress, without getting into enormous amounts of detail, is the pressure of the baby's head on the internal portion of mom's cervix. That is what begins the positive feedback loop between baby's body and mom's body, which causes the hormones to shift, which makes the cervix dilate and thin out and things to progress. And for some women, having a mechanical dilator like a Foley or a Cook's catheter is going to kind of help that process along a little bit. And I've had several clients who have had that option, utilized it, and had good success. Now, the studies that I've looked at, when you have a mechanical dilator like that, oftentimes inductions succeed better when they're followed by Pitocin. But we'll talk about Pitocin in a minute. So with the Foley, the cervix does not have to be super soft or super ripe, but it does need to be slightly open in order for that to get in. The benefits and risks of these things, you know, I go into a lot of detail in my classes and as a doula and talking to my clients, but just know that it is invasive. It is involving a vaginal exam, and you do want to know the person who is doing this is experienced in it so that it doesn't cause you too much discomfort. The next level, go ahead.
But I know a lot of moms are worried about movement and being restricted to the bed. So with the Foley catheter, does that come with restrictions to where you should not get out of the bed, or how does that interact with that?
Yeah, fantastic question. And thank you for asking it, because I did skip it. You're right. The catheter, once the saline solution is pushed through the catheter is capped and taped down onto your leg. You do not have to be attached to the fetal monitors, because there's no hormonal or chemical reaction that is going to happen in your body that they need to be aware of, potential uterine hyper behavior. So just tape the tube to the leg, and then mom is or birth giver is free to walk around and be in any movement that is most comfortable. You can still go to the bathroom and shower and do all of those things. You don't have to have an IV. So really, you're not hooked up to anything. There is, you know, some discomfort some women report with this, because if you've used tampons, you kind of know that feeling of a tampon. You've forgotten to remove it. You just have that kind of irritation in the cervix area. So they can feel that. And remember, the idea is for it to apply pressure to the inside of that cervix. So some women do report that that is an uncomfortable feeling. And occasionally then the nurse can come in and just traction that down a little bit to make sure that that pressure is continuing to be applied. It usually comes out on its own, somewhere between 3 and 5 centimeters, or just with us, you know, as the nurse is tractioning, it just kind of slips right out. And by then hopefully your body is starting to make the hormones that will allow labor to progress. And if not, that's when a lot of times they'll do a very low dose of Pitocin. There's also now Cervidil and Misoprostol, or it's also known as Cytotec. These are both prostaglandin, have a prostaglandin effect. The Cervidil is a PG2, and so it actually is more rapidly metabolized in the body. The Miso is a PG1, and it is taken either orally or vaginally. Now, what these are going to do is they're going to ripen your cervix. So if you think about like a piece of fruit, like a peach, when a peach is hard, it's not going to be really juicy. It's not going to be enjoyable to eat. You want to wait until that peach is just the right level of softness. And then you know that you're going to be able to enjoy it. And the cervix is very similar as far as birth goes. A hard cervix or a firm cervix needs to ripen in order for labor, for those uterine contractions to be really effective. So if a cervix is not ripe, then one of these methods is going to be what is chosen. Because if you just jump to Pitocin, Pitocin is a great uterine contractor, stimulating those contractions in the uterus, but it does nothing to ripen the cervix. So we hear stories of women who've had inductions with Pitocin and they're not happy stories. And they oftentimes will say, and I ended up with a cesarean anyway. And so sometimes that's because the cervix wasn't ripe enough. So how does somebody know if their cervix, what the status of their cervix is? You're going to have to get a vaginal exam. I am not a fan of vaginal exams. None of us wake up on a Tuesday and say, I have nothing on my calendar today. I think I'm going to go have a vaginal exam or a pap smear. Most of us avoid it as much as possible. So, but in this case, if you are considering a pharmaceutical medical-based induction, it is important to have a vaginal exam because you want to know your Bishop score. So the Bishop score is going to tell you really the status of your cervix. And it's more than just what dilation is it or how thin is it. They're also looking at the consistency of the cervix, the position of the cervix. Those things are all going to have an impact on how successful your induction might be. And so the recommendation is for a score of at least 6. Anything less than that, they say that you should probably have a ripener, and that's where the Cervidil or the Misoprostol come in. Now, these things can also cause uterine contractions, and it is something that should be considered as a possibility. So if you have a hyperactive uterus already, you may not want to go this route. You might want to explore with your provider ways of getting your uterus to settle down. Maybe you're dehydrated, so maybe getting a bag of fluids would be helpful and then figuring this out. Or maybe there could be any number of reasons, really, that this podcast would end up being 3 hours long if we went into all of them. But cervical ripeners, your choices are Cervidil, which is a gel, or your Misoprostol or Cytotec, which is a pill. And those help to ripen your cervix. So know your Bishop score, know that it's better than 6 if you're going to jump right to Pitocin. Now, I am of the mindset that Pitocin in the right hands, it's like any tool. It can be very beneficial and used very, very well. Pitocin does make the uterus contract, but it's wonderful because it can be controlled easily. It is on a pump. It is going into the body through an IV drip. It can be turned off. It can be turned on. It can be increased. It can decrease. And it has a very short life in the body. So it's really good in that, as opposed to the ripening, once they're in, especially the Misoprostol. Again, though, if your cervix isn't ripe, then jumping to Pitocin is not going to serve you well. Once you get in there and you start having Pitocin, then you can always ask them to go slow and low, which is the recommendation, because ideally, Pitocin is the synthetic form of the hormone that your body is wanting to produce for labor, and it should be used as a support, not to override what your body wants to do anyway. So that is something to consider in discussing with your provider. All of these pharmaceutical methods of induction have risks and benefits. And if you haven't gone into childbirth class, or if your childbirth class didn't cover the risks and benefits of these pharmaceutical methods, remember that 41% of women in the Listening to the Mother survey were induced. So we have a high level of induction in our society. So it is important to consider the possibility and what the benefits and risks are. Remember that those cervical ripeners do exhibit different actions on the receptors in the body. So just look at all of your options and discuss them with your doctor. So it is reasonable for a doctor to offer induction to a woman. ACOG states even at 39 weeks, but there are 3 important factors. So if you are considering induction with your doctor, have this conversation, or your midwife have this conversation with them. You want to talk about the values and preferences that you have as the birth giver. This is your body. This is your family. You are going to live with however this unfolds.
Yeah.
So discuss those values and preferences with your provider. Also, your provider is going to want to consider the staffing and facility resources that are available to assist with longer labors. Induction labors do oftentimes go on a lot longer than spontaneous labors. And some of that is because you don't have a ripe cervix right away. So they're trying to ripen it, which in a spontaneous situation can happen over the course of days or weeks even. And they're trying to get it into a shorter time by using pharmaceutical methods. So they need to make sure that their staffing is good. And this is of greater concern now during the pandemic
than it was at any other time.
Yes, for sure.
So you want to make sure that you have that discussion with your provider as well. Finally, and you mentioned this, Chana, that you had a failed induction for your son, which we will discuss in detail when we have our next birth story episode. But you do want to discuss the protocol for a failed induction with your provider. Do you have any kind of a conversation with your, did you have a midwife again with?
I did. Yeah, I had the same midwife with my son as I had with my daughter, but I did not have a conversation about what would happen if my body was not responding to the methods that were used for induction. So for a lot of birth givers, you know, they look at, they're going to the hospital, they're being induced, and then, you know, within a day or so, they're going to have their baby. So I think it's really important to have that conversation about what the protocols are if you're not responsive, or if you're not making the progress that your provider would have expected you to.
Yeah. Yeah. So really important conversation to have that I think you're not alone in looking back and saying, gosh, I wish I would have known.
Right.
And that's kind of why we're doing this episode. We didn't want to do this episode to get into all the nitty gritty of the risks and benefits of all of the options. I'm a childbirth educator, so anybody can go to my site, TranquilTouchForWomen.com, and sign up for a birthing class. I go over all of this stuff in detail and PowerPoints and all of that. And as a birth doula, that's information that you would give a client.
Right.
As you get to know them and you start talking about what their preferences are,
right,
and what their hopes and desires are for their babies. And end all is that as birth givers, we want to make the best choice for our babies and for our families.
Absolutely.
And knowing what our options are is really important. Understanding where natural things fall into the situation is also really important. And then if you decide to have a medical, pharmaceutical, hospitally managed induction, you should know exactly what you're getting into and why, and what your options are, because it's not one size fits all, like you had said earlier.
Yeah, that is so true. And all of this is just yet another reason why I believe that there should not be a birth without a doula. I mean, they're just the information, the knowledge, the support, it's invaluable. And that by far is one of the main things that I would have changed about both of my birth experiences. I would have definitely had a doula there to support and to help me make decisions, for that were best for my situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So the takeaways from this episode as we wrap up here would be, for natural methods, what would you recommend a takeaway be for that?
Do a lot of research. Talk to your provider to make sure that you're on the same page. And also, if you're going to do it and you're going to do it without any sort of medical backing, make sure you look at the dosage for everything. And that would be one of my most important things I would say. No, try to know your body and look at the dosing and just realize that not all of them are going to be effective. So if you're expecting a certain outcome, be prepared to not have that outcome come to fruition at first.
Right, right. Very good. And your due date, your baby's not a library book or a bill. Our babies, barring any medical reason that for our health or for our baby's health, that birth needs to happen our babies are good figuring it out along with our bodies. I always tell my clients, you don't wake up in the morning and say, on today's agenda, we're going to grow a nose.
Right.
Your baby grows and develops within you for the most part very well without any influence from the outside world. And more often than not, it happens spontaneously for labor and birth as well. And thirdly, if you do decide to go and that there is a reason, a good reason, and it might be a social reason, maybe having your baby within this time frame is ideal because this is when you'll have the most help and support at home. Maybe that is the reason. And you know what? That's okay if that's the best thing for your family, but know when you're going into it and explore the options with your provider. They won't necessarily offer to you, here's the menu of induction options offered at our facility. Choose which ones you would like.
Right.
So go into it knowing that you have options. If your cervix is fully closed, then a Foley or Cook is not going to be an option because it has to be slightly open. If it's slightly open, then maybe that is an option you want to consider before going into something that changes the hormonal balance within your system through a medication or chemicals. That's it. And next time we're going to share our induction stories. You've given us a little teases here and there today about yours.
I try not to go into much detail about it, but yeah, I'm excited to tell my story and to hear yours.
Yeah, I know that they're different. I know that much. And hopefully they will. I don't want anybody walking away from this afraid of pharmaceutical hospital-based inductions, because I have had one and I have seen others as a birth doula that have been absolutely textbook perfect, how you want it to be. And a lot of that involves just knowing what your options are and always being the one in the driver's seat. All right. So with that, we'll say goodbye and
we'll see you in 3 weeks.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Doula to Doula. Don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcast app.